welcome to Required Reading. This week we are talking about Redwall, the Brian Jakes story. Now, I had pronounced it Jacques before, but listening to him being interviewed, it is Jakes, so I apologize for the previous times when I probably got it wrong. In the meantime, I wanted to thank you all for being loyal listeners, doing what you do, and, you know, reach out to us. Follow michael.c.carroll on Instagram. Feel free to email us and message us, and it's all linked through your podcast reader, so you should be able to contact us through that. But in the meantime, please keep giving us ratings and reviews and letting us know what we're doing right and what you wish we would do more of. Thanks, everyone. Bye. Welcome to Required Reading. This week we are... we're going to start a fantasy series that I don't think we're going to finish, but we're doing Brian Jakes. Brian Jakes, Redwall, and we're sticking to the first one, which is not the first one chronologically, but the first one that was published, the one that's just titled Redwall. And I realize that this might be the last time I speak this entire episode, but this is... It's just Mike and I today.
Yep.
And it's one of his favorite fantasy novels and really got him into the genre. So why don't we just start there?
So I'll kind of explain how I ended up getting into the book itself and kind of the world that Brian Jakes creates. I will start off by saying that I didn't used to pronounce it Jakes. It's spelt like Jacques or Jocks. And it wasn't until this year when I was a couple of months ago when I was listening to the audiobook by Brian Jakes himself, where he pronounced it at the start of the audiobook as Brian Jakes. So I was kind of like floored by that. It's kind of like one of those things where like the linchpin of my childhood has been taken out now that I know that I've been mispronouncing his name all along. But nevertheless, Redwall has been, I know I said this at the end of our last episode, but it's been one of, if not the most influential book and books that that I've read. And I realize that as an English teacher, like we hold in very high acclaim what we would consider to be our top books or our favorite books, but Redwall has got to be at the top of that list for me. Right there alongside, I know you made a joke in the last podcast, Nick, but right there alongside Beowulf. Redwall, it's magnificent and I love it. And I was introduced to it when I was in second grade at a Scholastic book fair. I was walking through what was like a temporary library. We had it like moved around in my elementary school. And I was in Mrs. O'Hagan's class, shout out Mrs. O'Hagan. And we, for our English class, walked down to the library to look and peruse the books that were there for the Scholastic book fair. And I had my heart set as soon as I saw this picture, and I pulled it up, Nick, so that you can see it here. It's the old, it's from the, I think it's the 1997 edition. It has Matthias, who's, we'll get into, obviously, the plot of the story, but he's the protagonist, and he's hoisting up this sword that has a serpent wrapped around it, Asmodeus, we're led to believe, and again, we'll get into that later on. And there's this picture of this mouse who's on the front cover, and I saw this book and just fell in love with it. And I can remember reading the first couple of pages sitting in that library during the Scholastic's book fair. And then when it came time to leave, I didn't actually have any money with me because my parents didn't, they didn't know that we were going to be having a Scholastic's book fair in like second grade. And so Mrs. O'Hagan gave me like $6. And I used those $6 to buy Redwall. And I started reading it there in second grade. I can remember we had like drop everything and read time when I would go and like sit under a desk and just read Redwall feverishly because I loved this story so much. Backtracking even from there a little bit more, when I was in kindergarten, the St. Augustine's had these shout out St. Augustine's up on the North Shore of Boston. We had these like school plays, as I'm sure many elementary schools, and it was a K through 8 school, but I was one of the three blind mice in a production of the big bad wolf on trial. And as a result, I had this affinity for mice. I just, it was kind of like, maybe, I don't know, maybe I was like that weird kid back in middle school and elementary school that just like, that liked mice. But I think that that role in that play, like, got me interested in mice. And then it was this perfect storm where I saw this book and I started reading it. And my goodness gracious, Nick, I just never put them down. We were counting up, Nick and I, before this podcast, listeners out there, and I think it was 14 or 15 of these books that that I've read, and they all exist in this same mesmerizing world, and they're all like 400 pages or so. So it's a lot of reading that, especially in like second, third, fourth grade, when I was really enamored by these books. I mean, I was just when I think back to the books that I had in my hand in my childhood, it was always Brian Jakes. I now know that it's pronounced. It was always his Redwall books.
So this is the first one I've read. No, I mean, it's
a safe space, Nick. It's okay.
It's funny. It's just, so when we got into, I was around the same age as you when I got into genre fiction. Mm-hmm. And other than Roald Dahl, for the most part, I read a lot of science fiction, yeah. Right? Like that was the genre I got into. You know, I was reading Michael Crichton and Robin Cook and Arthur C. Clarke and that kind of thing. And that's just what it was. And like I've said here, like, I think I read one Tolkien book. Tolkien was, and I don't even think I read them in order until I was older. And then I picked up The Hobbit, and then I enjoyed that. But I will say something you pointed out, which is fascinating. Until, you know, the latter Harry Potter books, I just don't think of too many YA pieces that are more than 200 pages.
Yeah.
And these are all around 400, which,
yeah.
Again, it flies by. It's very easy to read. I don't feel like I got lost. But a lot of the books that I think of, you know, of Roald Dahl, they're never more than 200 pages.
No, at most.
Encyclopedia Brown, you know, yeah. Lewis Sacker, they're all – the Goosebumps books are about 150.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to have something this big that you were obsessed with is A, good on you, but B, proves that they can do it. And again, the latter Harry Potter books get up to be like 800-900 pages, but that is something that jumped out right away in this. And, you know, I had friends who read these books, just for whatever reason, you know, there's always a series that I'm ignorant on, which is fine. So I don't know exactly where you want to start with this, other than to throw out, like, this world is engaging. I'm surprised that there hasn't been a movie series or something.
Yeah.
I know there's been TV shows and the occasional video game. But
yeah, I think there was a TV show that came out. It was done by PBS, and it was animated. And believe it or not, I must have been in, like, gosh, like sixth or seventh grade or so when this animated PBS series, not necessarily when it came out, but when it was being shown up on the North Shore of Boston, because it was like on a Sunday in the springtime and we didn't happen to have anything going on, my family and I, and we like were just clicking through the stations and Redwall came, this story, this animated series came on the screen, and my parents, God love them, they like canceled all of our plans. They're like, Mike loves these books so much, and I can remember sitting like on their bed and watching the animated series as it was going through. I think that it was a TV show that they were showing on PBS, kind of like one episode right after the other. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up taking quite some time to kind of like sit and watch as this series was going on. But it was never done in like a movie or like a franchise way. I think a couple of years ago, because all of my family members know how much I loved these books, I was just saying to Nick that when a couple of the later books were coming out, Brian Jakes like took a little bit of a turn from the Redwall Abbey world of rodents into kind of like a human series that was based off of pirates. The first of them was entitled The Castaway, The Flying Dutchman. Yeah. And that year, and I think it was 2001 when that came out, I must have gotten like 5 copies of Castaway, The Flying Dutchman, because all of my family members knew that I loved these books so much. But kind of similarly, I think that there hasn't really been much of a TV show or a movie series or anything like that to pick up on what is like 20 22, 25. There's so many books that are in these series. And I had a couple of family members a short while ago, just a couple of years ago, that that let me know that there was going to be a Netflix show or something along those lines. But that ended up petering out maybe with COVID. But I think you're right. There really hasn't been an attempt to take this world and put it into either a movie or a digestible TV show. And maybe that's because of the size of the world that he's created. Yeah. I mean, if each of these books is 400 pages long and there's more than 20 of them, I mean, you can just imagine the scope. I mean, you're looking at an enormous world that he's created. Yeah. And so maybe that's part of the reason why it feels like a big endeavor. But I don't know. I look at that and I think to myself, now, obviously, I'm jaded and I love these books so much. But I think that it would be awesome to have something come out with them.
Well, maybe it's just my own childhood, but I just immediately, as I was reading this, thought of The Secrets of Nim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and again, someone like Don Bluth, who now in his 80s, but that animation style is what mm-hmm. this is. Or even more Disney, but The Great Mouse Detective, where Ratigan mm-hmm. is the villain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's 82, and then Great Mouse Detective is 86, and then The Rescuers is 77, and Rescuers Down Under is 90. Yeah. And it just seems like they were buying up these properties. It would have been great when there was only one book.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you could have kept it going. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, part of it, too, is a lot of the movies we've done, Fight Club comes to mind, Jurassic Park comes to mind. It's such a big scale. Thank God it fell into the right director's hands.
Yeah.
I could have seen – but his first, Brian Jake's writing style is so vivid. I can picture this. But B – I could see someone screwing it up.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that's part of it, too.
It's kind of in the same vein as Tolkien, right? And that's another one where thank goodness that fell into the right hands.
Right person came along.
With the creation of those cinematic versions of that piece. But I think that there's a lot of similarities in the writing style and the world building of Brian Jakes and Tolkien. And I think as a result of that, I think that it falls under the same category where, who knows, you know, if the Lord of the Rings movies hadn't fallen into the right hands either, because those would have been right around the same ish time, right? 2001 or so for the Fellowship and the Towers and Return of the King. So, you know, if it falls into the wrong hands, maybe it doesn't end up being the now I mean, and Tolkien was already such a global success, and he was already such a phenomenon. But the world that he created, I think it takes the right person to come around and bring that to life. And I would obviously love to see that happen with the Brian Jakes Redwall books. But if it were to happen with the wrong hands, I would be the first to accuse the movie of not being as good as the book.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, you just don't have someone sell tens of millions of copies
mm-hmm.
without it being novelized. And again, we will talk about this book. We will do our best to limit it to this book.
Yeah.
But as he said, he's read 22 or of the 22, he's read 14.
Yeah.
I have not. But this world is so big that at least I will just say now, I would recommend starting with this one. It's the first book, even though it's not chronologically anymore.
Yeah.
So it's easy to just jump in because mm-hmm. it assumes you don't know anything about it. And we get the story of Matthias and his visions. So
I'll before getting into the plot, which we will get into. But for those that are listening and are looking to not just read Redwall, but are interested in it and like the writing style and want to read more, I would suggest the other two that are kind of wrapped up in the same lineage as tightly as possible would be Redwall. And then Matameo is the name of Matthias's, the protagonist in Redwall's son. And then Martin the Warrior is a little bit of a spoiler, though we'll get into the plot in just a little bit. Martin the Warrior is actually the father of Matthias. So that lineage stays pretty succinct. So if you like Redwall, start with Redwall and then make your way into, I would say, Martin the Warrior and then into Matameo. And with those three, if you're still hooked at that point, you can branch off into any of the other books that are still in this world and consumed them just as ferociously as a young Mike Carroll did up on the North Shore of Boston. I will say last kind of like personal anecdote with these. I can remember reading Martin the Warrior in the Andover Public Library. It was walking distance from St. Augustine's, and I was nearing the end of the book. I was nearing the end of Martin the Warrior, and I was so enamored by the story that I couldn't wait to see what it is that happened next. So they had computers and everything that were at the Andover Public Library, and I pulled up the plot to Martin the Warrior. Yes, yes, Mr. Carroll of the English department at Marist was going to, this was before like Spark Notes were even a thing, but sure. I needed to know what ended up happening to Martin. He was engaged in this like incredibly intense sword fight, and I needed to know whether Martin the Warrior was going to end up making it out all right. And again, I apologize for the spoilers. You can plug your ears if you're listening at home, or take out the headphones, which I guess is the modern day equivalent of
skip ahead 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Skip ahead a little bit here, but Martin the Warrior does end up dying at the conclusion of that story. And I can remember being in the Andover Public Library in front of that computer screen and like highlighting on a website and trying to delete the words that Martin the Warrior had died. Like, I had no comprehension of how the internet worked, but I like somehow in my young like adolescent mind, I thought by deleting the words on the page, it was going to somehow resurrect and bring back to life, or somehow change the ending of this story that I loved of Martin the Warrior. And I had tears streaming down my face in the middle of this library as I'm trying to like bring back to life this character that I loved so much. But Martin the Warrior is great. Matameo is great. Just all of these books are so fantastic, and yeah. I have such vivid memories of reading them from when I was younger.
Well, and you know, you can get into your own literary journey later, but this book, this one we're going to talk about, is also a complete story. He obviously went on to great success, but Brian Jacques Jakes at that point had written poetry, written plays, written other things, and you know. He thought that this would just be another story he wrote, clearly, which is why it's a good place to start.
Yeah, and it ends up turning into his legacy, doesn't it? Right. So he, you're right. It wasn't the first thing that he wrote, but it did end up being this world that he created. Did end up being the last of what it is that he was writing. He continued to write this all the way up until Brian Jakes passed away. So it ended up being kind of like what it is that he ended up leaving as kind of like his bulwark. It kind of ended up being his legacy that he's leaving behind. So, and I'm so grateful for it. So I know we got to get into the plot. So I'll kind of just launch us into it, Nick. And then, I'm sure that there'll be kind of steps along the way where either you met with some confusion or something along those lines. So this is a story written and published 1986. And it starts off with the character following the character of Matthias. Matthias is living in Redwall Abbey as a young kind of like apprentice almost of Mortimer, who is the head abbot at Redwall Abbey. And he's not a very good like apprentice monk. He's not he does his best, but he always has these kind of like grander dreams of adventure. And so the mice that are living in Redwall Abbey, this is an abbey, of course, of mice, are preparing for like the summer harvest festival. It's kind of like the best description that I can give for it. And you learn very early on that Matthias wants adventure and is enamored by Martin the Warrior, who is known as the greatest warrior of Redwall Abbey throughout its history. We also have the romance between Matthias, who is a monk's apprentice, is kind of like learning to be a monk. But there's definitely clearly some romantic feelings that he has for Cornflower, which is kind of the female kind of, I guess, main character, you could go so far as to say. But in the midst of preparing for this harvest festival, this summer harvest festival, we kind of flash the perspective to the antagonist side of things, which is the character of Cluny the Scourge. Cluny the Scourge is a pirate Portuguese rat, and he has a razor on the tip of his tail, and he's kind of terrifying, all things considered. And this is was probably my second or third time making my way through it. And I was kind of thinking back to, like, man, I should have been more scared of Cluny the Scourge when I was in second grade and I was reading this for the first time. Cluny the Scourge has like a patch on one eye. He's got this like razor blade on the tip of his tail. And he is mounting an attack against Redwall Abbey. And so the first kind of glimpse that you get of Cluny, he has these galloping like horses. And it's kind of the first indication that these mice are kind of like, I don't know if you want to call them like human size. They have like horse-drawn carriages and things that are mentioned within the first couple of chapters. So it's an anthropomorphized world. All of these characters can talk, even right down to like Asmodeus, the snake that ends up being a villain character later on. All these characters can talk. They're all anthropomorphized, but their sizes, I think, was something that I was always a little bit confused by, but reminded in the first couple of chapters where they have horse-drawn carriages. So I don't know if you want to kind of like envision either very small horses or very large mice, but regardless, the world still works regardless of how it is that you want to look at it. But Cluny the Scourge is mounting this attack against Redwall Abbey. Early on during this attack, he takes like a ladder structure and tries to kind of infiltrate the abbey. He is denied access by Constance the Badger. So we get all these different types of rodents. And then a sneaky rat character, Shadow, ends up breaking into the abbey and stealing the beloved tapestry of Martin the Warrior. And when he is leaving the battlements of Redwall Abbey, ends up falling. He ends up being one of the first deaths that you get in this story. And something else that Nick and I were talking about beforehand is that this is a story that, while it is YA, Brian Jakes had no hesitation to kill off characters.
Right.
There's a lot of characters on the good side and on the bad side that are killed in this story. And so I'm kind of reminded of like in Tolkien's Hobbit versus the kind of the Lord of the Rings and the Fellowship of the Ring specifically, where you get like the death of Boromir, let's say, that happens during the Fellowship. And it's kind of an announcement. It's like, whoa, we're kind of in a big boy story here, you know, a little bit different in tone than the Hobbit. Well, in Redwall, you get death. You get a character, a mouse, that's stampeded by a horse-drawn carriage and dies within like the first three chapters. Right. So the Brian Jakes was not afraid to kill off characters. And I don't know, maybe at such a young age, it might have been an indication to me that like these are really cool stories. Not that a story needs to have death in it in order to be good or in order to be worthy of like enamoring its readers, but it's definitely it gave me the feel even at a young age that this was kind of a little bit more of a grown-up story than necessarily just a children's story. So you get the stealing of the tapestry, trying to figure out where it is that I want to kind of break for the plot here. Cluny tries to gain access, fails, ends up kidnapping Glendale and Cornflower in order to try and kind of like blackmail the gatekeeper at Redwall of letting their army in. And then those characters, Cornflower and Glendale, are saved by Matthias with the help of Basil Staghair, who's a hilarious rabbit that's in this story that is full of life and is kind of like added to the cast of characters around this time. So there you go. It's the first probably about third of the story just kind of launched right in.
So getting into this world, some of the stuff that you mentioned are where, I mean, it's a, you know, YA fantasy, so you suspend disbelief. But as you were kind of getting to, I find confusing as well.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it keeps up. Like, obviously, I think they refer to all of them as tribes. The yeah. animals have mm-hmm. different tribes, but like, the badger is massive and Cluny's afraid of it. The rat is bigger than the mice, but there's also horse-drawn carriages that are smaller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is that throughout all the novels, or does he like course correct and like?
No, it is kind of all throughout all of the novels. And, you know, I was kind of in preparing for the podcast going through and taking a look at some of the websites and fandom, and it's out there and it's extensive for Redwall. And I was looking at some of the consistencies of, and it's pretty remarkable how consistent he was able to
yeah.
to keep a lot of these different tribes and worlds and characters and species to try and kind of like keep them straight throughout it. They do have different like characteristics though that do hold true. Like the moles, for instance, speak in like a different dialect. Now it's still English, and for a second grade reader, I needed to probably spend three times as long during those passages. But you might even remember, Nick, that when the mole characters are encountered, it's actually kind of like the next part of the plot. But yeah. They go looking for the sword of the great Martin the Warrior, yeah. And in order to do so, they like consult the experts, who are the moles, who are digging the tunnels underneath the abbey, and their way of speaking is like almost, if you can consider, you know, we were just watching with our younger daughter Brave, and in that story there's a Scottish character who like it's even in the postscript, or what do you call it, like the
epilogue?
Like the words at the bottom of the screen. I'm just totally blanking.
Subtitles.
Thank you. I don't know how I blanked on subtitles, but even in the subtitles, it says like imperceptible Scottish accent, sure. Or something like that, right? It's kind of like the moles, right? They kind of have their own way of speaking, and you almost need like a translator, and Methuselah ends up being the translator for Matthias to kind of understand what these moles are talking about. But the way that the characters talk, whether you're looking at like rats tend to be on the more villainous side of things, whereas the mice and the field mice tend to be on the more kind of like protagonist side of things. The badgers are always kind of in the same realm as Constance. If you were to read Salamandastron or some of the like the stories that follow the badgers a little bit more, they're always seen as these like stoic kind of like keepers of the old way type of a thing, which is true of Constance. And so the different species of these animals do stay consistent throughout, and it's kind of almost reminiscent of like the elves from Tolkien, right? Or like the dwarves from Tolkien. And you can start to see how these different races of characters, they all, just like in Tolkien's stories, they all overlap at Redwall. And Redwall is kind of like the almost like the melting pot that kind of like brings all of these characters and all these species together.
Well, and I for you out there in TV land who are listening to this and thinking, maybe I don't know why anyone would listen to this show, but for those of you who do, I mean that in the best way possible. If you're someone who's out there who's trying to write your own fiction, like I said before, this book is a standalone novel, and then he, because it was popular, was able to go on from it. But that internal consistency is what makes this work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If there are rules to this world that are immediately broken, no one cares.
Yeah.
Then the world falls apart. And that's what you get when you get bad paperback fiction.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so, case in point, he clearly chose names that he thought sounded like it fits the world. Mm-hmm. Some of them have different meanings. You mentioned the snake. Asmodeus is like the son of the devil in ancient Hebrew. It doesn't make him any more evil here. It just sounds like it fits alongside Mortimer and Matthias.
Yeah.
Same with Cluny. Cluny is like a French castle. Who cares? It just sounds like it's right. That part doesn't matter. There are occasional allusions to Tolkien, but this is not a Tolkien knockoff.
Yeah.
It's not a Beowulf knockoff.
No.
He has his own internal order. He just chooses things that sound right. The book is better for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And the allusions that are made are more like based in legend than anything else. And I'll get into a couple of those, especially now that we're starting to talk about the sword and that they're looking for of Martin the Warrior. And there's kind of like almost checkpoints along the way where he's not like spinning off of Beowulf. He's not spinning off of Tolkien. He's almost like tipping his cap in a way that in Redwall specifically, I think, is marking kind of like his introduction into the fantasy world of writers. And this is a landmark work, I think, in fantasy. And it's kind of his introduction into this world. Yeah. And so to have a sword that is retrieved from Asmodeus's lair beneath a lake. I mean, you get the sword from the bottom of a lake, just like in King Arthur, from the Lady of the Lake, just like the sword that's brought up from the depths of Grendel's lair from the story of Beowulf. I mean, it's these moments that are like a tip of the cap, but they're never spinning off of them. It's almost like it's paying homage to these great fantasy stories of the past that are that he, as a writer, I get the impression, is indebted to. And Nick, you were talking before about writers who are trying to create fiction worlds that based off of like a world that they're creating. I mean, look no further. I'm sitting right here, like, yeah. I'm getting goosebumps from that, because I can remember reading the first couple of chapters of Redwall, and I stopped. It must have been somewhere in chapter 6 or chapter 7. There was a page break, and the Brian Jakes is describing just the sun rising up over the Abbey. And I stopped, and shout out Catherine. I read the passage out loud to my wife, and I said, "Does this sound like anybody?" And she said, "Like, Mike, that sounds like you're writing." Yeah. And so it was one of those moments where I realized just how indebted to, obviously, my studies with Beowulf. I'm super indebted to that Anglo-Saxon epic poem. But in terms of like my writing style, in terms of trying to create worlds with Beyond the Fall of Kings and the novels that I'm writing, like, I didn't realize until I was making my way through Redwall for probably the second or third time that it's very much indebted to Brian Jakes. Mm. So thank you, Brian Jakes, for all of that inspiration. I can kind of move us a little bit further in the plot. No, you got something else?
No, well, I just wanted to mention that rather than, say, being a Tolkien or whatever, this just screams to me Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is, you know, the power of myth, or, you know, the hero's journey, which is a strength, right? Like, if you're talking to someone and they're like, "Well, I'm working on this new fantasy novel," it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like, you know, a Tolkien book set during the Crimean War. Well, you've made two points of comparison.
Yeah.
And it might be great, but you've already hemmed yourself in a way where this is like, look, I just want Matthias. And there's ancient myths he deals with, but none of it is form-fitted. He just wants to make sure that Matthias is good, he's always honest, and he tries his thing, because Clooney, who's corrupt, lies.
Yeah.
And like, those basic archetype are what's there, down to the fact that, which we'll get to, which is really important in the next section, so I just want to mention it. Our hero, Martin the Warrior, is dead. This abbey, Redwall Abbey, kind of venerates him. And there's a tapestry of him, and we don't even know where he's buried, which is kind of the beginning of the second book. This is technically broken up into two books in the way that Tolkien is broken up into multiple books. Or is it three? This one's three.
This, I think, is three, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so this beginning section is how great the Martin is and what he means to this abbey, and that Matthias, who's an orphan, has no relation. Like, he wants to be the next Martin the Warrior.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then Clooney realizes what we have to do is break their spirits, and here's how we do it.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and you get the villainous character of Clooney, who then is having nightmares being chased by Martin the Warrior, right? And so he's getting these kind of like premonitions, and he's like talking to a soothsayer about these dreams that he's having too, because he's nervous that like the great Martin the Warrior is going to end up coming for him. And it ends up being at the end of the story, it's revealed that Matthias is actually in the lineage. He's the son of Martin the Warrior. And as Matthias is kind of like charging with, he ends up acquiring the sword. It's made clear that that's the vision that that premonition that Clooney was having those nightmares about. It ended up actually not being Martin the Warrior, but Matthias instead. So we get this moment where Matthias now, in order to try and kind of rally the rodents of Redwall, goes searching for the sword of Martin the Warrior. And so and this is where it becomes kind of cool, almost in like a Harry Potter type of a way, where you get like these riddles that need to be solved, and it's almost like the central letter, and like rearrange the different like letters end up spelling out Matthias from I Am That Is, which is part of the part of like this riddle that leads first Methuselah. We should say that he is kind of like the historian of Redwall Abbey, and he's kind of on this journey helping Matthias to find the sword. But they end up going behind the tapestry, down kind of like into the tombs, into the relics of Redwall, where the body of Martin the Warrior is supposed to be buried, and the sword is supposed to be there, and it's not. And so they solve another riddle, which leads them to realize that the sword is being used as the weather vane at the top of the abbey. So Matthias is kind of on this great venture to try and track down this sword. We now know that he's going to be needing to climb to the tallest heights at Redwall Abbey, and facing off against some of the birds that become kind of like an antagonist to Matthias as well. That's all as he's trying to acquire the sword. On Clooney's side of things, we get some runnings with some foxes. There's a defector fox, Sela, who ends up who Clooney ends up killing. So we're adding to Clooney's death count here. And then Chicken Hound is the son or brother of Sela, and Chicken Hound ends up being kind of like kidnapped and is taken prisoner inside of the Abbey of Redwall. And he's kind of like infiltrates Redwall with the guise of being injured and is brought in. And then he's escaping and he ends up killing accidentally Methuselah, who's been helping Matthias all along on this journey. And then Chicken Hound ends up going out into the woods of Mossflower, which is the surrounding kind of countryside. And it's then that we're introduced to Asmodeus, which is the snake that also kind of torments the rodent characters all around Redwall Abbey. It's kind of like a basilisk character, though.
Yes.
It does have like the ability to like stun and petrify with its sight, and is responsible for the death of a lot of the mice. Anyways, back to Matthias, who's now climbing up the battlements to try and retrieve this sword. Ends up getting into a skirmish with the Spera King. It's these like bird characters. Because of the name Spera, I've always kind of just associated them with sparrows, though I guess that's not necessarily one and the same. But the sword is being used as the weather vane at the top of the abbey, and Matthias ends up getting into this skirmish with King Spera, where he ends up plummeting down to kind of like the ground from the top of the abbey. Matthias ends up surviving, and he also saves. I can't remember exactly the chronology here, but he saves Warbeak, which is the kind of like the niece, I guess you could say, of the war king, this like King Spera. So once King Spera dies, Warbeak, which is this female kind of like queen, then becomes kind of like the queen of these bird characters. We're introduced as we're kind of like given the next step in the quest that Asmodeus the snake actually has the sword down in his lair. So now Matthias, this once humble monk, is now going to be facing off against this serpent, this snake in his lair. We're introduced at this point to Logalog, who is a shrew who's been tormented by Asmodeus. All the shrews have, we now kind of like are one step closer to, we know where the sword is, and Matthias is kind of making our way into the third part of the story, going to need to acquire the sword and then use it in order to end Clooney's attack on Redwall. So we'll pause there for a second before getting into the last third, I guess.
Yeah, just a couple things. Like a lot of us, I think, we get really – I usually get very bored with, like, a scavenger hunt section of a book or a movie. They do a good job of intercutting.
Mm-hmm.
We should mention, while this is going on, the whole time Clooney is threatening to destroy the abbey.
Yeah.
And so he's slowly building his army outside. There's even like a parlay between them and the abbey at one point, where he has to tie up his tail. And so what this does, and again, I don't know the first thing about writing novels or getting published, ask him, but like, this is very well storyboarded out.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Because he keeps cutting back and forth, almost as though he can sense, if we go on another section on this, it's going to cause fatigue.
Yeah.
So let's cut back to the action. And because of that, the fact that we have, you know, Matthias looking for a MacGuffin for almost a third of the book,
yeah,
it doesn't feel like it slogs.
Yeah.
Because at one point he's captured and yada, yada, yada. And it's down to him being who he is that convinces Warbeak to help him and all this, which is interesting, because something we talked about in Lord of the Rings a lot was, you know, is this supposed to represent World War I or is it not? Who are the dwarves supposed to be? Here you don't think about that for a second.
Yeah.
Like, and he does a good job of putting people on different footing, right? Obviously, everyone's afraid of the badgers. The foxes are big and scary, but trickable because they are greedy. The sparrows aren't very bright, but they're very self-absorbed.
Yeah.
And like they have their characteristics,
yeah,
but that allows him to play with this world. Who would be the best foil for these people? And because we have an establishing shot, we can kind of feel like this is going somewhere on purpose.
Yeah, and to kind of build off of that too, like, this is a story I think that thrives because of its storytelling and because of its narration. And I think if we were to just follow Matthias's story here, you might get kind of bogged down by this slog as we're trying to find the sword of Martin the Warrior. But you don't, because as soon as you get to the moment that that Matthias tumbles off of this abbey like parapet, now you flash over to Clooney, who's having another nightmare and is seeking out the soothsayer to try and figure out whether this is going to be a premonition that's going to end up haunting him. Or you flash over to like inside the abbey with Cornflower and their kind of attempts at patching back up the tapestry. So the broken narration, it's not broken chronologically, but the way that the way that Brian Jakes builds the story and then flashes to a different perspective and then flashes to a different perspective is so artfully done that I don't think that you grow tired of it. Yeah. And so you're able to follow along with this story without it ever getting stale, because at the moment that it would get stale, you all of a sudden flash to a different perspective. And while you might not be as enamored by Clooney's side of things as a Basil Stagg-Hare is infiltrating the enemy camp, and you might be a little bit more enamored by this search for the sword, you exist in the story for that chapter, and then you flash to a different narrative perspective. And I think it's the beauty of the way that it's written. It's done in such a tremendously – it's complex, but it's done in such a fluid manner that it happens so seamlessly, and you never fall out of touch with the story. And for me, I never fall out of love with the story, because you just kind of make your way through seamlessly one thread of the tapestry into the next.
You should see the vein bulging out of his forehead as he gets in. No, I mean, and case in point, something I want to bring up just as a characterization that's interesting. The fact that this is an abbey and the fact that there is an abbot mean nothing religiously,
yeah,
right? Like, you know, Clooney at one point says he's the Scourge and that Satan and he like hell's wounds and stuff.
Yeah.
But there, you know, and the abbot theoretically is a religious figure, but it's just shorthand that he's infinitely good and infinitely hopeful.
Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, I don't know what you think of when you picture an abbey. Think something older and, you know, probably English. But other than that, Clooney wants to turn it into his castle.
Yeah.
So it's just something with stone walls, stone building, a tower, as you alluded to. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's an interesting way to do shorthand, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he names the snake after a demon. Doesn't mean anything other than sounds evil, is evil,
yeah,
right? We have an abbot who, no matter what, he wants to help people. He'll welcome the fox in because he needs to give it aid and food because that's who he is. Mm-hmm. There's no blessing. Mm-hmm. That would slow the book down to a crawl. If all of a sudden we – like his inspirational speeches – there's not praying. We're thanking for the good things, but you know what I mean? Like, it's the parts of Lord of the Rings even that sometimes slow down when we're getting into the ancient religions and the creatures of the infinite, generally the elves who live forever, and there's old mythology that has religious significance. No. This is an action story.
Yeah, but at the same time, it still has those threads in it, right?
Yes.
You still get the songs that they're singing in the abbey that are indebted to Martin the Warrior. You still get those legends that are kind of like at the crux of it. So, but it's done so seamlessly that it weaves in with the plot and everything contributes to the plot rather than going off on a tangent that even in the story of even in something like Beowulf, right, where you get these long page long like songs that end up telling stories from the past and legends of the histories and the story of the Swedish wars and the story of the Frisian slaughter in Beowulf. All of these are told like tangentially.
Yes.
Nothing is tangential here. It's all still part of this riddle of Martin the Warrior, or it's part of like it all ends up contributing still to the continuation of the plot.
Well, and that's where this succeed. I mean, not to say that Beowulf or the Lord of the Rings does not succeed, but Tolkien clearly had his Silmarillion, and Beowulf is still partially a historical document.
Yeah.
Here's a list of kings.
Yeah.
They don't worry about that here, and all the there's no subtext. It all becomes text later on.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that keeps this moving. And maybe that's why it's a YA novel. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's good, efficient storytelling.
Yeah.
There's nothing you could really cut here that would improve the story.
Right.
Which is for, you know, which is worth mentioning. A lot of the things we talked about, oh, why did this happen mm-hmm. so long? I mean, I will say when I was reading about him being captured by the sparrows, it repeats itself. But each time it repeats itself, he's learning something new. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it lags, which is tricky in a 400-page,
yeah.
literally 350 pages was the version I read for kids.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. remarkable.
Yeah, it's incredible that it can stay that engaging. So just kind of bringing us through here, we'll kind of polish up the plot and then talk about if we've got any other last kind of thoughts. So we get the after the plummeting of Matthias kind of over the parapets of Redwall, it's revealed that Asmodeus is the one that has the sword. Or actually, it's revealed that Captain Snow, which is like this owl at one point, had taken the sword for himself. And so Matthias now is going off into Mossflower Wood to track down this Captain Snow, this owl that was the last one to see this sword. He's given this like medallion, this medal from Basil Staghair, who like this owl owes Basil Staghair because he saved his life at one point, owes him like a favor. So Matthias, holding this medal, goes off into Mossflower Wood, finds all these shrews that are deathly afraid of Asmodeus, as well as Gingivere Green Eyes, which is this peaceful like cat character who lives. It's like a barn cat who's just living in this barn, who has this like feud with Captain Snow, with this barn owl as well. And they're kind of like their longtime feud. They used to be friends, and they ended up like being enemies of one another. It's kind of like some comedic relief.
This means nothing, but that was a hobbit to me.
Yeah. Oh, right? Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's a hobbit name. It's a hobbit frustration. They hate their neighbors.
Oh, like... yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They hate their neighbors. Yeah, it's a great parallel.
Oh,
there.
The green eyes. For generations, we've hated the old green.
Right, yeah, no, exactly, exactly. So we get kind of like the introduction of this cat who, and it's that's another thing that Brian Jakes does so well, is that like you would think that, oh, clearly the cat is going to be the enemy of these mice. Like in a simple children's story, that might be the case, but the cat character, this Gingivere character, ends up being so much like almost more sophisticated than the mice, so detached from the mice of Redwall Abbey that he just like wants, or I can't remember if it's a he or a she, but Gingivere just wants to like do his or her own thing and like not get caught up in all these like skirmishes with these other mice. Whereas Captain Snow, this owl, has been eating the shrews and the mice and eventually tells Matthias where the lair of Asmodeus is. And it's revealed that there's an entryway to it, but it leads underneath, and the great lair of Asmodeus is underneath a lake. Don't have to get into the Beowulf illusion that's there, but the monster of Grendel and Grendel's mother is of course at the bottom of a lake, though somehow in like tunnels where the characters can breathe. It seems like a very kind of tip of the cap to Beowulf.
Right.
But the Captain Snow reveals to Matthias where the lair's entrance is. Matthias goes in and Logalog, the shrew that is kind of going along with him on this journey, ends up dying as he's so again the body count in this book is just rising. But Matthias ends up tracking down the sword of Martin the Warrior in the lair of Asmodeus and chops off the head of the great snake. Asmodeus kills the snake. So now, clad with the sword and shield of Martin the Warrior, it's been revealed through that riddle, I am that is, being rearranged into Matthias. Now the son of Martin the Warrior is returning back to Redwall Abbey, where they've gotten word it has been sacked. It has been infiltrated by Clooney because Clooney has taken hostage the family of the gatekeeper. And so the siege begins. The attack on Redwall Abbey begins. Clooney attacks Abbot Mortimer. He doesn't die yet. But in the midst of this fight, we get kind of the heroic moment when Matthias raises that sword in battling with Clooney when it seems that all hope is lost. But instead of striking, Clooney ends up striking the cord of the great bell of Redwall Abbey, and it goes plummeting and crashing down. around and kills Clooney the Scourge in this great heroic moment for Matthias that kind of ends this war on Redwall Abbey. It's not until the epilogue afterwards where you see kind of some of the aftermath. Abbot Mortimer is like, Matthias, I think that maybe you should be the defender and warrior rather than a monk. I think you've got more to offer us as a great warrior, son of the great Martin the Warrior. So Matthias becomes the defender of Redwall Abbey, ends up marrying Cornflower. So it's like you get a little bit of that romance there that's been alluded to. They have a child who they name Matameo, which is shortened for Matthias Methuselah Mortimer, named after all three of those mice. It gets shortened to Matameo, and then they end up forging out of the cracked bell of Redwall Abbey. They end up creating two new bells, Matthias, and I think the other one is Mortimer. It's either Mortimer or Methuselah they named the other bell after, after those deceased and beloved mice. And Mortimer, the head abbot, does kind of like pass away peacefully, knowing now that Matthias is going to be entrusted with the care of Redwall Abbey.
Well, and we get kind of a full fresh restart because there's also a new historian. And he, because we jump to a year later when we jump to Matameo being born, it's told through, well, it's time for the next festival.
Yep.
And we have
reset, right?
Right. And it's like a sitcom where nothing can truly end and comes back around. Mm-hmm. But like you said at the beginning, people actually die, which is.
Yeah.
God, I wish we could do that in Marvel or Star Wars anymore, because it makes a difference. It's an impact. This character we like dies, and then our heroes have to go on.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's the new historian. He's a little bit awkward. He's not quite sure of himself, but he does his best. And I like that story because to become the hero, Matthias has to be deceptive. He doesn't lie, but he has to slightly deceive. And the new historian isn't Methuselah. He's someone who's close, and everyone does their best, damn it. And that's cool.
It's endearing, right?
It is.
And I think that it does certainly set up what ends up. I don't even think that Brian Jakes, when he wrote this, would have known the enormity of the world that then, more than 20 years later, he was still, almost 30 years later, was still adding on to. As the Redwall legend and stories ended up getting greater and greater and greater, I don't even think that he could have possibly imagined the scope of the story. But he sets it up in such a way that it's an option for him. And we kind of started this off by saying that this was the first book that was written in the series, but it's number 9 chronologically. You by no means need to read 1 through 8 in order to understand what it is that's happening here. But it's almost like if there's 22 or 25 or however many stories that are in this enormous world that Brian Jakes has created, you kind of he starts with one that ends up being smack dab in the middle. You can almost like envision a spider web. And then these stories, whether they end up going back into the past, like the legend of Luke or Martin the Warrior or Salamandastron, they go back into the previous history that took place before Redwall, kind of like a prequel to Redwall. And then if you look at some of the ones that come afterwards, like the Pearls of Lutra or Matameo or Mossflower, all of these ones that take place afterwards, they're kind of moving forward in terms of this great plot and great world that's developing right before our eyes as we're reading more and more of these stories. So I think that like at first, I don't know if he had much of a glimpse as to what was taking place before or then after, but because it's book number 9, there's so much space to branch back and to branch forward that he creates more than just a book with Redwall. He creates the start of this kind of like universe that ends up branching off. And you were talking about being interested in seeing like the storyboard that would go along with this. I would be interested to see this entire story wall that branches together these stories, because there's really an interconnectivity that weaves them all together.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just, it's impressive because I know you're a writer, so and I don't mean to call any writers out, but when there's a big book or a big movement, it's so easy to be derivative. How many things like Game of Thrones have come out in the last 20 years?
Right.
Right. How, and again, this is the 80s when he's writing. this could have been like Star Wars.
Yeah.
It could have been like Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And there are elements there. There's a hero's journey, but it's just not. You know, no? Like, it could have been, he could have been the mouse that made contact with the human. Like, it could have been E.T. or something.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's Brian Jakes, and that's better for it.
Yeah.
It gives it much more of a timelessness.
Yeah.
And we've pointed to illusions here, but it is so clearly his world. It's not like, you know, this is someone who actually read this book and then made a movie or another book inspired by it. No. He clearly liked the genre and then wanted to do it himself. And this book is impressive for that.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah. You know, like, what's the closest this is to? Like, The Wind in the Willows?
Maybe, kind of. But I think that it's more Tolkien. I think that there's not in terms of its writing style. I don't know anything that is quite as reminiscent of Redwall as Redwall. But I think that in terms of the scope and the story and the world building, I think Tolkien is probably the closest thing, but to say that, I don't think does either Tolkien or Brian Jakes justice. I think that they're doing their own things, as we've said so many times over the course of this podcast, and they both do it so well and at their own right that, man, if it hasn't become clear enough, I cannot recommend Redwall enough. And whether you continue to read more of the books, whether you're going to be like a young Mike Carroll up on the North Shore crying in a library over the death of Martin the Warrior or not, if you like fantasy books and you are at all interested, you should pick it up and read it. And it's funny, in you were talking a little bit earlier, Nick, about like to talk with his editor, to talk to Brian Jakes's agent would be kind of such an interesting conversation, because he is doing something that's so unique and so creative in what it is that he's coming up with. But in kind of like the agenting world and the manuscript world of manuscript requests and publishing that I'm like waist deep in right now, there's in many cases an instance where you need to explain similar authors to your writing style. And sometimes I hesitate to write Brian Jakes's name down, because I think that there's this preconceived notion that Brian Jakes, because he's writing books that are understandable by people in second, third, fourth grade, that it's a children's story. But I think that that doesn't do Brian Jakes justice. There's so much more that's going on, and these stories are complex, and the worlds he's creating are so beautiful, and the weaving of these narrations is so masterfully done that I do think that some of my writing reflects some of that narration in terms of like the line to line. But I don't want to write down, sometimes I hesitate to write down Brian Jakes, because if you don't know him and you haven't read the story, then you might get the impression that the writing style is like a children's story.
Right.
And it's not. I think that it's far more akin to Tolkien than it is to like Roald Dahl.
No.
And I think that the story is just so masterful. And so what I've started doing actually is I write down Brian Jakes, and then for the like book, I write down The Castaway, The Flying Dutchman, because I tell myself if anybody is familiar enough with Brian Jakes, they're going to know the story and they'll know then kind of a little bit more about my writing style. But if they were just to see Redwall, I fear that editors and agents might kind of write off what I'm writing as a children's story, which it isn't. Whereas if they know the story, they might better know the name Brian Jakes, and thus a little bit more about what he's really doing here, which I think is, it's a masterpiece. It really is.
Well, and I will just summarize by saying I did enjoy it. And so maybe I will take a different lesson from Mike's story, which is sometimes you just need to walk through the library or walk through the book fair.
Yeah.
and I mean that in the best way possible.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Sometimes you just – like, I would never have picked this up if we hadn't done it, because part of it is that I thought it was a kid's book, and part of it is that fantasy novels get massive. We were talking back and forth about what, like, other fantasy books to do, and we were joking, like – my buddy recommends Hyperion to me all the time. It's like 1,200 pages. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, when am I going to have the time or keep my attention that long?
Yeah.
And so the fact of the matter is you never know what's going to be the book that inspires you to do something.
Yeah.
And I frankly think all of us should try to be a writer. I don't think 25% of us at most will get anything published ever. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you sit down and try to put your thoughts together is an important exercise. Yeah. And, you know, frankly, I don't know if what point Mike decided he was going to be a fantasy author any more than I figured I would be a historian. But clearly someone pulled that trigger in your brain.
Yeah.
And that's what it means to wander down the halls of the racks in the library and just say, huh, this looks good.
Yeah.
I would recommend this. Pick it up. I would say start with this one. And then if you like, Matameo is literally the next one, both chronologically and in publishing order.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why not? But yeah, no, I enjoyed this and I'd recommend it to anyone. I'll see if my daughter is interested in maybe a year or two. She's 7. So maybe 8 or 9, maybe 10.
Yeah,
but it's right there.
I've been waiting for when I can read these books to my daughter, and I can't wait for that day to come. I'm being told frequently that she's 2.5 right now.
Right.
So she is far from old enough to even understand what's going on with Redwall. But Catherine keeps holding me at bay that she's not ready for Redwall just yet. But I do await that day anxiously, because as I'm sure you can tell from this podcast, it's a beloved book by me.
So this episode's coming out soon. Mike, what do you got to publish or push or whatever?
Yeah, so first, the Instagram account, michael.c.carroll. So thank you, everybody, for all of your support. This is going to be I'm kind of right in the midst of some publications that are coming out. You can go and take a look on that Instagram account. On the links that I have there, there will be a new one by the time this podcast comes out for Carmina Magazine, which will have the story of Upon a Painted Ocean, which is a retelling of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner with starships in outer space. So it's this really cool story that I wrote based off of some science fiction, and it's kind of a retelling and reimagining of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So go ahead and take a look there. And then audiobook-wise, I'm going to be doing a story that's based off of Paradise Lost with Brooklyn bootleggers from the 1920s, and that's Against Heaven's Matchless King. So that'll be something that'll be coming out right here on the podcast, so you guys can take a listen to that and let me know what you think. Thanks for everybody that shares and likes and subscribes, and for keeping us on the charts.
Yeah. Usually here we would plug the next episode, but we're letting Mike choose, because I feel like we've gotten to dominate the podcast recently. And unfortunately, he's just not here today. So as soon as I know, I'll let you know. But we're going to try to make an effort to push the year out strong and finish where we can. But thanks for doing all you do, like he said. And we'll see you soon.
Yep.
Bye, everyone. Required Reading is a product of Maris Podcasting and Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and co-hosted by Mike Burns and Mike Carroll. It is edited and produced by Nick Hoffman. The theme is Sands by Davis Burns. The opinions expressed are opinions of the hosts and the guests, but not of Marist School. All rights reserved. Thanks!